but by now it was too dark to see much. At one place where the shore came in near the road, I parked and walked to the beach. It was a moonless night, and I could hear the sea before I could see it, coming in with a slow, rhythmic whoosh, whoosh. I went and stood at the water's edge. The waves fell onto the beach like exhausted swimmers. The wind played at my jacket. I stared for a long time out across the moody sea, the black vastness of the Atlantic, the fearsome, primordial, storm-tossed depths from which all of life has crawled and will no doubt one day return. And I thought, I could murder a hamburger. In the morning, I drove into Newport, America's premier yachting community, home of the America's Cup races. The old part of town had been fixed up in recent years, by the look of it. Shops with hanging wooden signs out front lined the streets. They all had jauntily nautical names, like The Flying Ship and Shore Thing. The harbor was almost too picturesque, with its crowds of white yachts and bare masts undulating beneath a sky in which gulls danced and reeled. But all around the fringe of the downtown there were unsightly parking lots, and a busy four-lane road, more freeway than city street, divided the waterfront from the town. Spindly trees stood along it like scrawny afterthoughts. The city had also built a little park, Parrot Park, but it was unkempt and full of graffiti. I had not encountered this kind of neglect before. Most American towns are spotless, and this really surprised me, especially considering the importance of tourism to Newport. I walked up Thames Street, where some fine old sea captains' homes were fighting a losing battle with litter and dog shit, and the encroachment of gas stations and car transmission places. It was all very sad. This was a place where the people didn't seem to care, or perhaps just didn't notice how shabby they had let things grow. It reminded me of London. I drove out to Fort Adams State Park across the bay. From there, Newport looked another town altogether, a charming cutout of needle-shaped church spires and Victorian rooftops protruding from a parkland of trees. The bay glittered in the sunshine, and its scores of sailboats bobbed on the gentle waves. It was captivating. I drove on along the shore road past Brenton Point, and then down Bellevue Avenue, where the most fabulous summer homes ever built line the road on both sides and spill over onto many of the streets beyond. Between about 1890 and 1905, America's richest families, the Vanderbilts, the Astors, the Belmonts, dozens of others, tried to outdo each other by building magnificent homes, which they insisted on calling cottages, all along this half-mile strip of imposing cliffs. Most were loosely modeled on French chateaux, and filled with furniture, marble, and tapestries, shipped at huge expense from Europe. Hostesses routinely spent $300,000 or more on entertainment for a season that lasted only 6 or 8 weeks. For 40 years or so, this was the world headquarters of conspicuous consumption. Most of the houses are now run as museums. They charge an arm and a leg to get in, and in any case the queues outside most of them were enormous. This was the Columbus Day weekend, remember. You can't see much from the street. The owners didn't want common people staring at them as they sat on the lawn counting their money, so they put up dense hedges and high walls. But I discovered, quite by chance, that the city had built an asphalt footpath all along the cliff edge, from which I could see the backs of the grander mansions, as well as enjoy giddying views of the ocean breaking onto the rocks far below. I had the path almost to myself, and walked along it in a state of quiet amazement, with my mouth open. I had never seen such a succession of vast houses, such an excess of architecture. Every house looked like a cross between a wedding cake and a state capitol building. I knew that the grandest of all the houses was the Breakers, built by the Vanderbilts, and I kept thinking, well, this must be it. And, now surely this must be it. But then the next house along would be even more awesome. When at last I reached the Breakers, it was absolutely enormous. A mountain with windows. You can't look at it without thinking that nobody, with a possible exception of oneself, deserves to be that rich. On the other side of the fence, the lawns and terraces were full of pudgy tourists in Bermuda shorts and silly hats, wandering in and out of the house, taking pictures of each other and trampling the begonias. And I wondered what Cornelius Vanderbilt would make of that, the dog-faced old prick. I drove on to Cape Cod, another place I'd never been and for which I had high expectations. It was very picturesque, with its old salt-box homes, its antique shops and wooden inns, its pretty villages with quaint names, Sagamore, Sandwich, Barnstable, Rock Harbor. But it was jam-packed with tourists and overloaded cars and rumbling motorhomes. Boy, do I hate motorhomes, especially on crowded peninsulas like Cape Cod, where they clog the streets and block the views. And also that some guy and his dumpy wife can eat lunch and empty their bladders without stopping. The traffic was so dense and slow-moving that I almost ran out of gas and just managed to limp into a two-pump station outside West Barnstable. It was run by a man who was at least 97 years old. He was tall and rangy and very spry. I've never seen anybody pump gas with such abandon. First he slopped a quantity of it down the side of the car, and then he got so engaged in talking about where I came from.
"Iowa, eh? We don't get many from Iowa. I think you're the first this year. What's the weather like in Iowa this time of year?"
That he let the pump run over, and I had to point out to him that gasoline was cascading down the side of the car and gathering in a pool at our feet. He withdrew the nozzle, sloshing another half-gallon over the car and down his trousers and shoes, and kind of threw it back at the pump, where it dribbled carelessly. He had a cigarette butt plugged into the side of his mouth, and I was terrified he would try to light it. And he did. He pulled out a crumpled book of matches and started to fidget one of them to life. I was too stunned to move. All I could think of was a television newsreader saying, "And in West Barnstable today, a tourist from Iowa suffered third-degree burns over 98% of his body in an explosion at a gas station. Fire officials said he looked like a piece of toast that had been left under the grill too long. The owner of the gas station has still not been found." But we didn't explode. The little stub of cigarette sprouted smoke, which the man puffed up into a good-sized billow, and then he pinched out the match with his fingers. I suppose after all these decades of pumping gas, he'd become more or less incombustible, like those snake handlers who grow immune to snake venom. But I wasn't inclined to test this theory too closely. I paid him hastily and pulled straight back onto the highway, much to the annoyance of a man in a 40-foot motorhome who dropped mustard on his lap in braking to avoid me. "That'll teach you to take a building on vacation," I muttered uncharitably, and hoped that something heavy had fallen on his wife in the back. Cape Cod is a long, thin peninsula that sprouts out of the base of Massachusetts, runs out to sea for 20 miles or so, and then curls back in on itself. It looks like an arm, flexed to make a muscle. In fact, it looks remarkably like my arm, because there's almost no muscle in it. There are three roads along the lower part of the peninsula. One along the north shore, one along the south shore, and one up the middle. But at the peninsula's elbow, at Rock Harbor, where it narrows and abruptly turns north, the three roads come together, and there is just one long, slow highway up the forearm to Provincetown at the fingertips. Provincetown was swarming with tourists. The town has just one route in and one route out. Only a few hundred people live there, but they get as many as 50,000 visitors a day during the summer and at holiday weekends, such as this one. Parking was not allowed in the town itself. There were mean-spirited tow-away warnings everywhere. So I paid a couple of bucks to leave my car with several hundred others, out in the middle of nowhere, and trudged a long way into town. Provincetown is built on sand. All around it stand rolling dunes, broken only by occasional clumps of straw-colored grass. The names of the businesses, Windy Ridge Motel, Gale Force Gift Shop, suggested that wind might be something of a local feature. And indeed there was sand drifted across the roads and piled in the doorways, and with every whipping breeze it flew in your eyes and face and dusted whatever food you happened to be eating. It must be an awful place to live. I might have disliked it less if Provincetown had tried just a little harder to be charming. I had seldom seen a place so singularly devoted to sucking money out of tourists. It was filled with ice cream parlors and gift shops and places selling T-shirts, kites, and beach paraphernalia. I walked around for a while and had a hot dog with mustard and sand and a cup of coffee with cream and sand and had a look in a window of a real estate agency, where I noticed that a basic two-bedroom house by the beach was on offer at $190,000, though it did include a fireplace and all the sand you could eat. The beaches looked nice enough, but apart from that I couldn't see a single real attraction in the place. Provincetown is where the Pilgrim Fathers first touched American soil in 1620. There's a big campanile-type tower in the middle of the town to commemorate the event. The Pilgrims, curiously enough, didn't mean to land on Cape Cod at all. They were aiming for Jamestown in Virginia, but missed their target by a mere 600 miles. I think that is a considerable achievement. Here's another curious thing. They didn't bring with them a single plow, or horse, or cow, or even a fishing line. Does that strike you as just a little bit foolish? I mean to say, if you were going to start a new life in a land far, far away, don't you think you would give some thought to how you were going to fend for yourself once you got there? Still, for all their shortcomings as planners, the Pilgrim Fathers were sufficiently on the ball not to linger in the Provincetown area, and at the first opportunity they pushed on to mainland Massachusetts. So did I. I had hoped to go to Hyannisport, where the Kennedys had their summer home, but the traffic was so slow, especially around Woods Hole, where the ferry to Martha's Vineyard departs, that I dared not. Every motel I passed, and there were hundreds, said no vacancy. I got on Interstate 93, thinking I would follow it for a few miles just to get away from Cape Cod and start looking for a room. But before I knew it, I was in Boston, caught in the evening rush hour. Boston's freeway system is insane. It was clearly designed by a person who had spent his childhood crashing toy trains. Every few hundred yards, I would find my lane vanishing beneath me, and other lanes merging with it from the right or left, or sometimes both. This wasn't a road system. It was mobile hysteria. Everybody looked worried. I had never seen people working so hard to keep from crashing into each other. And this was a Saturday. God knows what it must be like on a weekday. Boston is a big city, and its outer suburbs dribble on and on all the way up to New Hampshire. So, late in the evening, without having any clear idea of how I got there, I found myself in one of those placeless places that sprout up along the junctions of interstate highways, purplishly lit islands of motels, gas stations, shopping centers, and fast food places, so brightly lit they must be visible from outer space. This one was somewhere in the region of Haverhill. I got a room in a Motel 6 and dined on greasy fried chicken and limp French fries at a Denny's restaurant across the way. It had been a bad day, but I refused to get depressed. Just a couple of miles down the road was New Hampshire, and the start of the real New England. Things could only get better. Chapter 16. I had always thought that New England was nothing but maple trees and white churches, and old guys in checked shirts sitting around iron stoves and country general stores, swapping tall tales and spitting in the cracker barrel. But if Lower New Hampshire was anything to go by, clearly I had been misinformed. There was just modern commercial squalor, shopping centers, gas stations, motels. Every once in a while there would be a white church or clapboard inn standing incongruously in the midst of Burger Kings and Texacos. But far from mollifying the ugliness, it only intensified it, reminding you what had been thrown away for the sake of drive-through burgers and cheap gasoline. At Salisbury, I joined old Route 1, intending to follow it up the coast through Maine. Route 1, as the name suggests, is the patriarch of American roads, the first federal highway. It stretches for 2,500 miles from the Canadian border to the Florida Keys. For 40 years, it was the main highway along the eastern seaboard, connecting all the big cities of the north, Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore, Washington, with the beaches and citrus groves of the south. It must have been wonderful in the 1930s and 1940s to drive from Maine to Florida on vacation, going through all those big, marvelous cities, and then passing onto the hills of Virginia and the green mountains of the Carolinas, getting warmer with the passing miles. But by the 1960s, Route 1 had become too congested to be practical. A third of all Americans live within 20 miles of it. And Interstate 95 was built to zip traffic up and down the coast with only the most fleeting sense of a changing landscape. Today, Route 1 is still there, but you would need weeks to drive its entire length. Now it's just a local road, an endless city street, an epic stretch of shopping malls. I had hoped that here in rural New England it would retain something of its former charm, but it seemed not to. I drove through a chill morning drizzle and wondered if ever I would find the real New England. At Portsmouth, an instantly forgettable little town, I crossed over into Maine on an iron bridge over the gray Piscataqua River. Seen through the rhythmic swish of windscreen wipers, Maine, too, looked ominously unpromising, a further sprawl of shopping centers and muddy new housing developments. Beyond Kennebunkport, the suburbs at last gave way to forest. Here and there, massive brown boulders emerged eerily from the earth like subterranean creatures coming up for air, and occasionally I caught glimpses of the sea, a gray plain, cold and bleak. I drove and drove, thinking that any moment now I would encounter the fabled Maine of lobster pots and surf-battered shores and lonely lighthouses standing on rocks of granite. But the towns I passed through were just messy and drear, and the countryside was wooded and unmemorable. Once outside Falmouth, the road ran for a mile or so along a silvery bay with a long, low bridge leading over it to a landscape of snug farms nestled in a fold of hills, and I got briefly excited. But it was a false alarm, and the landscape quickly grew dull again. The rest of the time, the real Maine eluded me. It was always just over there, like the amusement parks my dad used to miss. At Wiscasset, a third of the way up the coast to New Brunswick, I lost heart altogether. Wiscasset bills itself on the signboard at the edge of town as the prettiest village in Maine, which doesn't say a whole lot for the rest of the state. I don't mean to suggest that Wiscasset was awful, because it wasn't. It had a steep main street lined with craft shops and other yuppie emporia sloping down to a placid inlet of the Atlantic. Two old wooden ships sat rotting on the bank. It was okay. It just wasn't worth driving 4 hours to get there. Abruptly, I decided to abandon Route 1 and plunge northward into the dense pine forests of central Maine, heading in an irregular line for the White Mountains on a road that went up and down like a rucked carpet. After a few miles, I began to sense a change of atmosphere. The clouds were low and shapeless, the daylight meager. Winter, clearly, was closing in. I was only 70 miles or so from Canada, and it was evident that winters here were long and severe. It was written in the crumbling roads and in the huge stacks of firewood that stood outside each lonely cabin. Many chimneys were already sprouting a wintry wisp of smoke. It was barely October, but already the land had the cold and lifeless feel of winter. It was a kind of atmosphere that makes you want to turn up your collar and head for home. Just beyond Gilead, I passed into New Hampshire, and the landscape became more interesting. The White Mountains rose up before me, big and round, the color of wood ash. Presumably they take their name from the birch trees that cover them. I drove on an empty highway through a forest of trembling leaves. The skies were still flat and low, the weather cold, but at least I was out of the monotony of the Maine woods. The road rose and fell and swept along the edge of a boulder-strewn creek. The scenery was infinitely better. But still there was no color, none of the brilliant golds and reds of autumn that I had been led to expect. Everything from the ground to the sky was a dull, cadaverous gray. I drove past Mount Washington, the highest peak in the northeastern U.S., 6,288 feet, for those of you who are keeping notes. But its real claim to fame is as the windiest place in America. It's something to do with, well, with the way the wind blows, of course. Anyway, the highest wind speed ever recorded anywhere on Earth was logged on the top of Mount Washington in April 1934, when a gust of, pencils ready, 231 miles an hour whistled through. That must have been an experience and a half for the meteorologists who worked up there. Can you imagine trying to describe a wind like that to somebody? Well, it was, you know, real windy. I mean, really windy. You know what I'm saying? It must be very frustrating to have a truly unique experience. Just beyond it, I came to Bretton Woods, which I had always pictured as a quaint little town. But in fact, there was no town at all, just a hotel and a ski lift. The hotel was huge and looked like a medieval fortress, but with a bright red roof. It looked like a cross between Monte Cassino and a Pizza Hut. It was here in 1944 that economists and politicians from 28 nations got together and agreed to set up the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. It certainly looked a nice place to make economic history. As John Maynard Keynes remarked at the time in a letter to his brother, Milton, "It has been a most satisfactory week. The negotiations have been cordial. The food here is superb, and the waiters are ever so pretty. I stopped for the night at Littleton, which, as the name suggests, was a little town near the Vermont border. I pulled into the Littleton Motel on the main street. On the office door was a sign that said, "If you want ice or advice, come before 6:30. I'm taking the wife to dinner."
"And about time, too, wife."
Inside was an old guy on crutches, who told me I was very lucky because he had just one room left. It would be $42 plus tax. When he saw me start to froth and back off, he hastily added,
"It's a real nice room, got a brand new TV, nice carpets, beautiful little shower. We've got the cleanest rooms in town. We're famous for that."
He swept an arm over a selection of testimonials from satisfied customers, which he displayed under glass on the countertop.
"Our room must have been the cleanest room in town, A.K., Aardvark Falls, Kentucky. Boy, was our room ever clean. And such nice carpets.
Mr. and Mrs. J.F., Spotweld, Ohio." That sort of thing. Somehow I doubted the veracity of these claims, but I was too weary to return to the road. So with a sigh, I said all right and signed in. I took my key and a bucket of ice. At $42 plus tax, I intended to have everything that was going. And went with him to my room. And by golly, it was the cleanest room in town. The TV was brand new, and the carpet was plush. The bed was comfortable, and the shower really was a beauty. I felt instantly ashamed of myself and retracted all my bad thoughts about the proprietor.
"I was a pompous little shit to have doubted you, Mr. B.B., Des Moines, Iowa."
I ate 14 ice cubes and watched the early evening news. This was followed by an old episode of Gilligan's Island, which the TV station had thoughtfully put on as an inducement to its non-brain-damaged viewers to get up immediately and go do something more useful. This I did. I went out and had a look around the town. The reason I had chosen to stop for the night in Littleton was that a book I had with me referred to it as picturesque. In point of fact, if Littleton was characterized by anything, it was a singular lack of picturesqueness. The town consisted principally of one long street of mostly undistinguished buildings, with a supermarket parking lot in the middle and the shell of a disused gas station a couple of doors away. This, I think we can agree, does not constitute picturesqueness. Happily, the town had other virtues, for one thing. It was the friendliest little place I'd ever seen. I went into the topic of the town restaurant. The other customers smiled at me. The lady at the cash register showed me where to put my jacket. And the waitress, a plump and dimpled little lady, couldn't do enough for me. It was as if they had all been given some kind of marvelous tranquilizer. The waitress brought me a menu, and I made the mistake of saying, "Thank you."
"You're welcome," she said.
Once you start this, there's no stopping. She came and wiped the table with a damp cloth. "Thank you," I said. "You're welcome," she said. She brought me some cutlery wrapped in a paper napkin. I hesitated, but I couldn't stop myself. "Thank you," I said. "You're welcome," she said. Then came a placemat with "Topic of the Town" written on it, and then a glass of water, and then a clean ashtray, and then a little basket of saltine crackers wrapped in cellophane, and at each we had our polite exchange. I ordered the fried chicken special. As I waited, I became uncomfortably aware that the people at the next table were watching me and smiling at me in a deranged fashion. The waitress was watching me, too, from a position by the kitchen doorway. It was all rather unnerving. Every few minutes she would come over and top up my iced water and tell me that my food would only be a minute. "Thank you," I'd say.
"You're welcome," she'd say.
Eventually the waitress came out of the kitchen with a tray the size of a tabletop and started setting down plates of food in front of me. Soup, salad, a platter of chicken, a basket of steaming rolls. It all looked delicious. Suddenly I realized that I was starving.
"Can I get you anything else?" she said.
"No, this is just fine, thank you," I answered, knife and fork plugged in my fists, ready to lunge at the food.
"Would you like some ketchup?"
"No, thank you."
"Would you like a little more dressing for your salad?"
"No, thank you."
"Have you got enough gravy?"
"There was enough gravy to drown a horse."
"Yes,
plenty of gravy, thank you."
"How about a cup of coffee?"
"Really, I'm fine."
"You sure there's nothing I can do for you?"
"Well, you might just piss off and let me eat my dinner," I wanted to say, but I didn't, of course. I just smiled sweetly and said, "No, thank you," and after a while she withdrew. But she stood with a pitcher of iced water and watched me closely the whole meal. Every time I took a sip of water, she would come forward and top up my glass. Once, when I reached for the pepper, she misread my intentions and started forward with the water pitcher, but then had to retreat. After that, whenever my hands left the cutlery for any reason, I would semi-mime an explanation to her of what I was going to do. I'm just going to butter my roll now, so that she wouldn't rush over to give me more water. And all the while, the people at the next table watched me eat and smiled encouragingly. I couldn't wait to get out of there. When at last I finished, the waitress came over and offered me dessert.
How about a piece of pie? We got blueberry, blackberry, raspberry, boysenberry, huckleberry, hortleberry, cherryberry, harryberry, chuckberry, and berryberry.
Gosh, no thanks. I'm too full, I said, placing my hands on my stomach. I looked as if I had stuffed a pillow under my shirt.
Well, how about some ice cream? We've got chocolate chip, chocolate fudge, chocolate ripple, chocolate vanilla fudge, chocolate nut fudge, chocolate marshmallow swirl, chocolate mint with fudge chips, and fudge nut with or without chocolate chips.
Have you got just plain chocolate?
No, I'm afraid there's not much call for that.
I don't think I'll have anything then.
Well, how about a piece of cake? We've got really no thank you. A cup of coffee?
No thank you.
You sure now?
Yes, thank you.
Well, I'll just give you a little more water then.
And she was off for the water jug before I could get her to give me my bill. The people at the next table watched this with interest and smiled a smile that said,
"We are completely off our heads. How are you?"
Afterwards, I had a walk around the town. That is to say, I walked up one side of the street and down the other. For the size of place, it was a nice town. It had two bookstores, a picture gallery, a gift shop, a movie house. People on the sidewalk smiled at me as I passed. This was beginning to worry me. Nobody, even in America, is that friendly. What do they want from me? Up at the far end of the street there was a BP service station, the first one I'd seen in America. Feeling vaguely homesick for Blighty, I walked up to have a look at it, and was disappointed to see that there wasn't anything particularly British about it. The guy behind the counter wasn't even wearing a turban. When he saw me looking in the window, he smiled at me with the same strange, unsettling smile. Suddenly I realized what it was. It was the look of someone from outer space. That odd, curiously malevolent B-movie smile of a race of interplanetary creatures who have taken over a small town in the middle of nowhere as their first step towards becoming Earth Masters. I know this sounds improbable, but crazier things have happened. Look who's in the White House, for Christ's sake. As I strolled back to the motel, I gave everyone I passed that same eerie smile, thinking I ought to keep on their good side, just in case. And you never know, I remarked to myself in a low voice, if they do take over the planet, there might be some openings for a guy of your talents. In the morning I got up very early to a day that promised splendor. I peered out of my motel window. A pink dawn was spilled across the sky. I dressed quickly and hit the road before Littleton had even begun to stir. A few miles out of town, I crossed the state line. Vermont presented an altogether greener, tidier prospect than New Hampshire. The hills were fat and soft like a sleeping animal. The scattered farms looked more prosperous, and the meadows climbed high up the rolling hillsides, giving the valleys an alpine air. The sun was soon high and warm. On a ridge overlooking an expanse of hazy foothills, I passed a sign that said, "Peachum, settled 1776," and beyond that stood a village. I parked beside a red general store and got out to have a look around. There was no one about. Presumably the people of Littleton had come in the night and taken them off to the planet Zog. I walked past the Peachum Inn, white clapboard, green shutters, no sign of life, and wandered up a hill past a white congregational church and pleasant, dozing houses. At the crest of the hill stood a broad green with an obelisk and flagpole, and beside it an old cemetery. A zephyr wind teased the flag. Down the hill, across a broad valley, a series of pale green and brown hills rolled away to the horizon like the swells of a sea. Below me the church bell tolled the hour, but otherwise there was not a sound. This was as perfect a spot as I had ever seen. I had a look at the obelisk. "Commemorating Peachum Soldiers, 1869," it said, and had names carved in it. Good New England names like Elijah W. Sargent, Lowell Stearns, Horace Rowe. There were 45 names in all, too many surely for a mere hamlet in the hills. But then the cemetery beside the green also looked far too large for the size of town. It covered the hillside, and the grandeur of many of the monuments suggested that this had once been a place of wealth. I went through the gate and had a look around. My eye was caught by one particularly handsome stone, an octagonal marble column surmounted by a granite sphere. The column logged the copious deaths of Hurds and their near relatives from Captain Nathan Hurd in 1818 to Francis H. Bement in 1889. A small panel on the back said, Nathan H. died July 24, 1852, aged 4 years, 1 month. Joshua F. died July 31, 1852, aged 1 year, 11 months. Children of J. and C. Pitkin. What could it have been, I wondered, that carried off these two little brothers just a week apart? A fever? It seemed unlikely in July. An accident in which one died and the other lingered? Two unrelated events? I pictured the parents crouched at Joshua F.'s bedside, watching his life ebb, praying to God not to take him as well, and having their hopes crushed. Isn't life shitty? Everywhere I looked, there was disappointment and heartbreak recorded in the stones. Joseph, son of Ephraim and Sarah Carter, died March 18, 1846, age 18 years. Alma Foster, daughter of Zadok and Hannah Richardson, died May 22, 1847, age 17 years. So many were so young. I became infected with an inexpressible melancholy as I wandered alone among these hundreds of stilled souls, the emptied lives, the row upon row of ended dreams. Such a sad place. I stood there in the mild October sunshine, feeling so sorry for all these luckless people and their lost lives, reflecting bleakly on mortality and on my own dear, cherished family so far away in England. And I thought, well, fuck this, and walked back down the hill to the car. I drove west across Vermont, into the Green Mountains. The mountains were dark and round, and the valleys looked rich. Here, light seemed softer, sleepier, more autumnal. There was color everywhere, trees the color of mustard and rust, meadows of gold and green, colossal white barns, blue lakes. Here and there along the roadside, produce stands brimmed with pumpkins and squash and other autumn fruits. It was like a day trip to heaven. I wandered around on back roads. There was a surprising lot of small houses, some little better than shacks. I suppose there couldn't be much work in a place like Vermont. The state has hardly any towns or industry. The biggest city, Burlington, has a population of just 37,000. Outside Groton, I stopped at a roadside cafe for coffee and listened along with the other three customers to a fat young woman with a pair of ill-kempt children moaning in a loud voice about her financial problems to the woman behind the counter.
I still only get $4 an hour, she was saying. Harvey, he's been at Fibbert's for 3 years, and he's only just got his first raise. You know what he gets now? $4.65 an hour. Isn't that pathetic? I told him. I said, Harvey, they're just walking all over you, but he won't do nothing about it.
She broke off here to rearrange the features on one of her children's faces with the back of her hand.
How many times have I told you not to interrupt me when I'm talking?
She inquired rhetorically of the little fellow. And then, in a calmer voice, turned back to the cafe lady and launched into a candid list of Harvey's other shortcomings, which were manifold. Only the day before, in Maine, I had seen a sign in a McDonald's offering a starting wage of $5 an hour. Harvey must have been immensely moronic and unskilled, doubtless both, not to be able to keep pace with a 16-year-old burger jockey at McDonald's. Poor guy. And on top of that, here he was married to a woman who was slovenly, indiscreet, and had a butt like a barn door. I hoped old Harvey had sense enough to appreciate all the incredible natural beauty with which God had blessed his native state, because it didn't sound as if he had blessed Harvey very much. Even his kids were ugly as sin. I was half tempted to give one of them a clout myself as I went out of the door. There was just something about his nasty little face that made you itch to smack him. I drove on, thinking what an ironic thing it was that the really beautiful places in America, the Smoky Mountains, Appalachia, and now Vermont, were always inhabited by the poorest, most undereducated people. And then I hit Stowe and realized that when it comes to making shrewd generalizations, I am a cretin. Stowe was anything but poor. It was a rich little town full of she-she boutiques and expensive ski lodges. In fact, for most of the rest of the day, as I wandered around and through the Green Mountain ski resorts, I saw almost nothing but wealth and beauty. Rich people, rich houses, rich cars, rich resorts, beautiful scenery. I drove around quite struck by it all, wandered over to Lake Champlain, also immensely beautiful, and idled down the western side of the state, just over the border from New York State. Below Lake Champlain, the landscape became more open, more rolling, as if the hills had been flattened out from the edges like someone pulling a crease out of a bedspread. Some of the towns and villages were staggeringly pretty. Dorset, for instance, was an exquisite little place, standing around an oval green full of beautiful white clapboard houses, with a summer playhouse and an old church and an enormous inn. And yet there was something about these places. They were too perfect, too rich, too yuppified. At Dorset, there was a picture shop called the Dorset Framery. At Bennington, just down the road, I passed a place called the Public House Restaurant, P-U-B-L-Y-K. Every inn and lodge had a quaint and picturesque name, the Black Locust Inn, the Hob Knob, the Blueberry Inn, the Old Cutter Inn, and a hanging wooden sign out front. There was always this air of twee artifice pushing in on everything. After a while, I began to find it oddly oppressive. I longed to see a bit of neon and a restaurant with a good old family name, Ernie's Chop House, Zweiker's New York Grill, with a couple of blinking beer signs in the front window. A bowling alley or drive-in movie theater would have been most welcome. It would have made it all seem real. But this looked as if it had been designed in Manhattan and brought in by truck. One village I went through had about 4 stores, and one of them was a Ralph Lauren polo shop. I couldn't think of anything worse than living in a place where you could buy a $200 sweater, but not a can of baked beans. Actually, I could think of a lot of worse things. Cancer of the brain, watching every episode of a TV miniseries starring Joan Collins, having to eat at a burger chef more than twice in 1 year, reaching for a glass of water in the middle of the night and finding that you've just taken a drink from your grandmother's denture cup, and so on. But I think you get my point. Chapter 17. I spent the night in Cobleskill, New York, on the northern fringes of the Catskills, and in the morning drove to Cooperstown, a small resort on Lake Otsego. Cooperstown was the home of James Fenimore Cooper, from whose family the town takes its name. It was a handsome town, as handsome as any I had seen in New England, and more replete with autumn color, with a main street of square-topped brick buildings, old banks, a movie theater, family stores. The Cooperstown diner, where I went for breakfast, was busy, friendly, and cheap, all that a diner should be. Afterwards, I went for a stroll around the residential streets, shuffling hands in pockets through the dry leaves and down to the lakeside. Every house in town was old and pretty. Many of the larger ones had been converted into inns and expensive B&Bs. The morning sunlight filtered through the trees and threw shadows across the lawns and sidewalks. This was as nice a little town as I had seen on the trip. It was almost amalgam. The only shortcoming with Cooperstown is that it's full of tourists, drawn to the town by its most famous institution, the Baseball Hall of Fame, which stands by a shady park at the far end of Main Street. I went there now, paid $8.50 admission, and walked into its cathedral-like calm. For those of us who are baseball fans and agnostics, the Hall of Fame is as close to a religious experience as we may ever get. I walked serenely through its quiet and softly lit halls, looking at the sacred vestments and venerated relics from America's national pastime. Here, beautifully preserved in a glass case, was the shirt worn by Warren Spahn when registering win number 305, which tied him with Eddie Plank for most by a left-hander. Across the aisle was the glove used by Sal Magley on September 25, 1958, no-hitter versus Phillies. At each case, people gazed reverently or spoke in whispers. One room contained a gallery of paintings commemorating great moments in baseball history, including one depicting the first professional night game under artificial lighting played in Des Moines, Iowa, on May 2, 1930. This was exciting news to me. I had no idea that Des Moines had played a pivotal role in the history of both baseball and luminescence. I looked closely to see if the artist had depicted my father in the press box, but then I realized that my father was only 15 years old in 1930 and still in Winfield. This seemed kind of a pity. In an upstairs room, I suppressed a whoop of joy at the discovery of whole cases full of the baseball cards that my brother and I had so scrupulously collected and catalogued, and which my parents, in an early flirtation with senility, had taken to the dump during an attic spring cleaning in 1981. We had the complete set for 1959 in mint condition. It is now worth something like $1,500. We had Mickey Mantle and Yogi Berra as rookies, Ted Williams from the last year he hit 400, the complete New York Yankees teams for every year between 1956 and 1962. The whole collection must have been worth something like $8,000, enough at any rate to have sent Mom and Dad for a short course of treatment at a dementia clinic. But never mind, we all make mistakes. It's only because everyone throws these things out that they grow so valuable for the lucky few whose parents don't spend their retirements getting rid of all the stuff they spent their working lives accumulating. Anyway, it was a pleasure to see all the old cards again. It was like visiting a friend in hospital. The Hall of Fame is surprisingly large, much larger than it looks from the road, and extremely well presented. I wandered through it in a state of complete contentment, reading every label, lingering at every display, reliving my youth, cocooned in a happy nostalgia. And when I stepped back out onto Main Street and glanced at my watch, I was astonished to discover that 3 hours had elapsed. Next door to the Hall of Fame was a shop selling the most wonderful baseball souvenirs. In my day, all we could get were pennants and baseball cards and crummy little pens in the shape of baseball bats that stopped working about the second time you tried to sign your name with them. But now, little boys could get everything with their team's logo on it. Lamps, towels, clocks, throw rugs, mugs, bedspreads, and even Christmas tree ornaments. Plus, of course, pennants, baseball cards, and pens that stop working about the second time you use them. I don't think I have ever felt such a pang of longing to be a child again. Apart from anything else, it would mean I'd get my baseball cards back and I could put them somewhere safe where my parents couldn't get at them. Then when I got to my age, I could buy a Porsche. I was so taken with all the souvenirs that I began to fill my arms with stuff. But then I noticed that the store was full of "Do Not Touch" signs, and on the counter by the cash register had been taped a notice that said, "Do not lean on glass. If you break, cost to you is $50. What a jerky thing to say on a sign. How could you expect kids to come into a place full of wonderful things like this and not touch them? This so elevated my hackles that I deposited my intended purchases on the counter and told the girl I didn't want them after all. This was perhaps just as well, because I'm not altogether sure that my wife would have wanted St. Louis Cardinals pillowcases. My ticket to the Hall of Fame included admission to a place on the edge of town called the Farmers Museum, where a couple of dozen old buildings, a schoolhouse, a tavern, a church, and the like, have been preserved on a big site. It was about as exciting as it sounds, but having bought the ticket, I felt obliged to go and have a look at it. If nothing else, the walk through the afternoon sunshine was pleasant. But I was relieved to get back in the car and hit the road again. It was after 4 by the time I left town. I drove on across New York State for several hours through the Susquehanna Valley, which was very fetching, especially at this time of day and year, in the soft light of an autumn afternoon. Watermelon-shaped hills, golden trees, slumbering towns. To make up for my long day in Cooperstown, I drove later than usual, and it was after 9 by the time I stopped at a motel on the outskirts of Elmira. I went straight out for dinner, but almost every place I approached was closed, and I ended up eating in a restaurant attached to a bowling alley, in clear violation of Bryson's third rule of dining in a strange town. Generally, I don't believe in doing things on principle. It's a kind of principle of mine. But I do have 6 rules of public dining to which I try to adhere. They are, 1, never eat in a restaurant that displays photographs of the food it serves, but if you do, never believe the photographs. 2, never eat in a restaurant with flock wallpaper. 3, never eat in a restaurant attached to a bowling alley. 4, never eat in a restaurant where you can hear what they are saying in the kitchen. 5, never eat in a restaurant that has live entertainers with any of the following words in their titles: Hank, Rhythm, Swinger, Trio, Combo, Hawaiian, Polka. And 6, never eat in a restaurant that has bloodstains on the walls. In the event, the bowling alley restaurant proved quite acceptable. Through the wall, I could hear the muffled rumblings of falling bowling pins and the sounds of Elmira's hairdressers and grease monkeys having a happy night out. I was the only customer in the restaurant. In fact, I was quite clearly the only thing standing between the waitresses and their going home. As I waited for my food, they cleared away the other tables, removed the ashtrays, sugar bowls, and tablecloths, so that after a while, I found myself dining alone in a large room with a white tablecloth and flickering candle in a little red bowl amid a sea of barren formica tabletops. The waitresses stood against the wall and watched me chew my food. After a while, they started whispering and tittering, still watching me as they did so, which, frankly, I found a trifle unsettling. I may only have imagined it, but I also had the distinct impression that someone was little by little turning a dimmer switch, so that the light in the room was gradually disappearing. By the end of my meal, I was finding my food more or less by touch, and occasionally by lowering my head to the plate and sniffing. Before I was quite finished, when I had just paused for a moment to grope for my glass of iced water somewhere in the gloom beyond the flickering candle, my waitress whipped the plate away and put down my bill.
"You want anything else?"
she said in a tone that suggested I had better not. "No, thank you," I answered politely. I wiped my mouth with a tablecloth, having lost my napkin in the gloom, and added a seventh rule to my list. Never go into a restaurant 10 minutes before closing time. Still, I never really mind bad service in a restaurant. It makes me feel better about not leaving a tip. In the morning, I woke early and experienced that sinking sensation that overcomes you when you first open your eyes and realize that instead of a normal day ahead of you, with its scatterings of simple gratifications, you are going to have a day without even the tiniest of pleasures. You are going to drive across Ohio. I sighed and got up. I shuffled around the room in my old man posture, gathered up my things, washed, dressed, and without enthusiasm, hit the highway. I drove west through the Alleghenies and then into a small, odd corner of Pennsylvania. For 200 miles, the border between New York and Pennsylvania is a straight line. But at its northwestern corner, where I was now, it abruptly juts north, as if the draftsman's arm had been jogged. The reason for this small cartographical irregularity was to let Pennsylvania have its own outlet onto Lake Erie, so that it wouldn't have to cross New York State. And it remains today a 200-year-old reminder of how the early states weren't at all confident that the Union was going to work. That it did was far more of an achievement than is often appreciated nowadays. Just inside the Pennsylvania state line, the highway merged with Interstate 90. This is the main northern route across America, stretching 3,016 miles from Boston to Seattle, and there were lots of long-distance travelers on it. You can always tell long-distance travelers because they look as if they haven't been out of the car for weeks. You only glimpse them when they pass, but you can see that they've already started to set up home inside. There are pieces of washing hanging in the back, remnants of takeaway meals on the windowsill, and books, magazines, and pillows scattered around. There's always a fat woman asleep in the front passenger seat, her mouth hugely agape, and a quantity of children going crazy in the back. You and the father exchange dull but not unsympathetic looks as the two cars slide past. You glance at each other's license plates and feel envy or sympathy in proportion to your comparative distances from home. One car I saw had Alaska plates on it. This was unbelievable. I had never seen Alaska license plates before. The man must have driven over 4,500 miles, the equivalent of going from London to Zambia. He was the most forlorn-looking character I had ever seen. There was no sign of a wife and children. I expect by now he had killed them and put their bodies in the trunk. A drizzly rain hung in the air. I drove along in that state of semi-mindlessness that settles over you on interstate highways. After a while, Lake Erie appeared on the right. Like all the Great Lakes, it is enormous. More an inland sea than a lake, stretching 200 miles from west to east and about 40 miles across. 25 years ago, Lake Erie was declared dead. Driving along its southern shore, gazing out at its flat gray immensity, this appeared to be a remarkable achievement. It hardly seemed possible that something as small as man could kill something as large as a great lake. But just in the space of a century or so, we managed it. thanks to lax factory laws and the triumph of greed over nature in places like Cleveland, Buffalo, Toledo, Sandusky, and other bustling centers of soot and grit, Lake Erie was transformed in just 3 generations from a bowl of blue water into a large toilet. Cleveland was the worst offender. Cleveland was so vile that its river, a slow-moving sludge of chemicals and half-digested solids called the Cuyahoga, once actually caught fire and burned out of control for 4 days. This also was a remarkable achievement, I feel. Things are said to be better now. According to a story in the Cleveland Free Press, which I read during a stop for coffee near Ashtabula, an official panel with a ponderous title of the International Joint Commission's Great Lakes Water Quality Board had just released a survey of chemical substances in the lake, and it had found only 362 types of chemical, compared with more than 1,000 the last time they had counted. That still seemed an awful lot to me, and I was surprised to see a pair of fishermen standing on the shore, hunched down in the drizzle, hurling lines out onto the greenish murk with long poles. Maybe they were fishing for chemicals. Through dull rain, I drove through the outer suburbs of Cleveland, past signs for places that were all called Something Heights, Richmond Heights, Maple Heights, Garfield Heights, Shaker Heights, University Heights, Warrensville Heights, Parma Heights. Curiously, the one outstanding characteristic of the surrounding landscape was its singular lack of eminences. Clearly what Cleveland was prepared to consider the heights was what others would regard as distinctly middling. Somehow this did not altogether surprise me. After a time, Interstate 90 became the Cleveland Memorial Shoreway and followed the sweep of the bay. The windscreen wipers of the Chevette flicked hypnotically, and other cars threw up spray as they swished past. Outside my window, the lake sprawled, dark and vast, until it was consumed by a distant mist. Ahead of me, the tall buildings of downtown Cleveland appeared and slid towards me, like shopping on a supermarket conveyor belt. Cleveland has always had a reputation for being a dirty, ugly, boring city, though now they say it is much better. By they, I mean reporters from serious publications like the Wall Street Journal, Fortune, and the New York Times Sunday Magazine, who visit the city at 5-yearly intervals and produce long stories with titles like Cleveland Bounces Back and Renaissance in Cleveland. No one ever reads these articles, least of all me. So I couldn't say whether the improbable and highly relative assertion that Cleveland is better now than it used to be is wrong or right. What I can say is that the view up the Cuyahoga as I crossed it on the freeway was of a stew of smoking factories that didn't look any too clean or handsome. And I can't say that the rest of the town looked such a knockout either. It may be improved, but all this talk of a renaissance is clearly exaggerated. I somehow doubted that if the Duke d'Urbino were brought back to life and deposited in downtown Cleveland, he would say, "Goodness, I am put in mind of 15th-century Florence and the many treasures therein." And then, quite suddenly, I was out of Cleveland and on the James W. Shocknessy Ohio Turnpike in the rolling rural emptiness between Cleveland and Toledo, and highway mindlessness once more seeped in. To relieve the tedium, I switched on the radio. In fact, I had been switching it on and off all day, listening for a while, but then giving up in despair. Unless you have lived through it, you cannot conceive of the sense of hopelessness that comes with hearing Hotel California by the Eagles for the 14th time in 3 hours. You can feel your brain cells disappearing with little popping sounds. But it's the disc jockeys that make it intolerable. Can there anywhere be a breed of people more irritating and imbecilic than disc jockeys? In South America, there's a tribe of Indians called the Hanamanos, who are so backward they cannot even count to 3. Their counting system goes 1, 2, oh, gosh, a whole bunch. Obviously, disc jockeys have a better dress sense and possess a little more in the way of social skills, but I think we're looking at a similar level of mental acuity. Over and over, I searched the airwaves for something to listen to, but I could find nothing. It wasn't as if I was asking for all that much. All I wanted was a station that didn't play endless songs by bouncy prepubescent girls, didn't employ disc jockeys who said, "Hey!" more than once every 6 seconds, and didn't keep telling me how much Jesus loved me. But no such station existed. Even when I did find something halfway decent, the sound would begin to fade after 10 or 12 miles, and the old Beatles song that I was listening to, with quiet pleasure, would gradually be replaced by a semi-demented man talking about the Word of God and telling me that I had a friend in the Lord. Many American radio stations, particularly out in the hinterland, are ridiculously small and cheap. I know this for a fact because when I was a teenager, I used to help out at KCBC in Des Moines. KCBC had the contract to broadcast the Iowa Oaks professional baseball games, but it was too cheap to send its sportscaster, a nice young guy named Steve Shannon, on the road with a team. So whenever the Oaks were in Denver or Oklahoma City or wherever, Shannon and I would go out to the KCBC studio, really just a tin hut standing beside a tall transmitter tower in a farmer's field somewhere southeast of Des Moines, and he would broadcast from there as if he were in Omaha. It was bizarre. Every couple of innings, someone at the ballpark would call me on the phone and give me a bare summary of the game, which I would scribble into a scorebook and pass to Shannon, and on the basis of this, he would give a 2-hour broadcast. It was a remarkable experience to sit there in a windowless hut on a steaming August night, listening to the crickets outside and watching a man talking into a microphone and saying things like, "Well, it's a cool evening here in Omaha with a light breeze blowing in off the Missouri River. There's a special guest in the crowd tonight, Governor Warren T. Legless, who I can see sitting with his pretty young wife, Bobby Ray, in a box seat just below us here in the press box." Shannon was a genius at this sort of thing. I remember one time the phone call from the ballpark didn't come through. The guy at the other end had gotten locked in a toilet or something, and Shannon didn't have anything to tell the listeners. So he delayed the game with a sudden downpour, having only a moment before said it was a beautiful, cloudless evening, and played music while he called the ballpark and begged somebody there to let him know what was going on. Funnily enough, I later read that the exact same thing had happened to Ronald Reagan when he was a young sportscaster in Des Moines. Reagan responded by having the batter do a highly improbable thing, hit foul balls one after the other for over half an hour, while pretending that there was nothing implausible about it, which, when you think about it, is kind of how he ran the country as president. Late in the afternoon, I happened onto a news broadcast by some station at Crudbucket, Ohio, or some such place. American radio news broadcasts usually last about 30 seconds. It went like this. A young Crudbucket couple, Dwayne and Wanda Dreary, and their 7 children, Ronnie, Lonnie, Connie, Donnie, Bonnie, Johnny, and Tammy Wynette, were killed in a fire after a light airplane crashed into their house and burst into flames. Fire Chief Walter Embers said he could not at this stage rule out arson. On Wall Street, shares had their biggest one-day fall in history, losing 508 points. And the weather outlook for Greater Crudbucket? Clear skies with a 2% chance of precipitation. You're listening to radio station KRUD, where you get more rock and less talk. Then there followed Hotel California by the Eagles. I stared at the radio, wondering whether I had heard that second item right. The biggest one-day fall in shares in history? The collapse of the American economy? I twirled the dial and found another news broadcast. But Senator Poontang denied that the use of the 4 Cadillacs and the trips to Hawaii were in any way connected with the $120 million contract to build the new airport. On Wall Street, shares suffered their biggest one-day fall in history, losing 508 points in just under 3 hours. And the weather outlook here in Crudbucket is for cloudy skies and a 98% chance of precipitation. We'll have more music from the Eagles after this word. The American economy was coming apart in shreds, and all I could get were songs by the Eagles. I twirled and twirled the dial, thinking that surely somebody somewhere must be giving the dawn of a new Great Depression more than a passing mention. And someone was, thank goodness. It was CBC, the Canadian network, with an excellent and thoughtful program called As It Happens, which was entirely devoted that evening to the crash of Wall Street. I will leave you, listener, to consider the irony in an American citizen traveling across his own country having to tune into a foreign radio network to find out the details of one of the biggest domestic news stories of the year. To be scrupulously fair, I was later told that the Public Service Network in America, possibly the most underfunded broadcast organization in the developed world, also devoted a long report to the crash. I expect it was given by a man sitting in a tin hut in a field somewhere, reading scribbled notes off a sheet of paper. At Toledo, I joined Interstate 75 and drove north into Michigan. heading for Dearborn, a suburb of Detroit where I intended spending the night. Almost immediately I found myself in a wilderness of warehouses and railroad tracks and enormous parking lots leading to distant car factories. The parking lots were so vast and full of cars that I half wondered if the factories were there just to produce sufficient cars to keep the parking lots full, thus eliminating any need for consumers. Interlacing all this were towering electricity pylons. If you have ever wondered what becomes of all those pylons you see marching off to the horizon in every country in the world, like an army of invading aliens, the answer is that they all join up in a field just north of Toledo, where they discharge their loads into a vast estate of electrical transformers, diodes, and other contraptions that look for all the world like the inside of a television set, only on a rather grander scale, of course. The ground fairly thrummed as I drove past, and I fancied I felt a crackle of blue static sweep through the car, briefly enlivening the hair on the back of my neck and leaving a strangely satisfying sensation in my armpits. I was half inclined to turn around at the next intersection and go back for another dose, but it was late and I pressed on. For some minutes I thought I smelled smoldering flesh and kept touching my head tentatively, but this may only have been a consequence of having spent too many lonely hours in a car. At Monroe, a town halfway between Toledo and Detroit,